Accession number 29953, Reel 7.
Reel 7. Yes, food and drink.
Yes, well, the actual drink as borak is just rice wine, and it's actually quite fine, but the thing to remember is that, at least I was told this, and it works out for me, you get a tumbler of borak, which is a reasonable size one, it's a rice wine, it's a dirty looking liquid, and the thing to do is either hold your nose and drink it down first, or else don't breathe in and drink your first drink. After that you can let your nose go, it's all right. But it's not very alcoholic, it's quite reasonable, it's just like a light beer, but it is a normal drink. But we had enough of it, more than enough probably at times, but the rice is short supply with the war and that sort of thing, so they didn't use much. I only had arak once, and we stopped off at one place, and one of the party, better not name him, he must be a kind of alcoholic, because we were offered this arak to drink. Other members of the party refused it, but he wanted it. And I didn't like, he was a Scot as well, unfortunately. I didn't like the idea of him drinking this with a whole bottle of the stuff, drinking it himself. So I said I'd have some. So they poured me out a glass, but I managed to pour it out all the time, and he kept drinking it until he was utterly throttled. It took him 3 days to recover. Oh, it was ridiculous. He just got onto it, and he just wouldn't stop. And of course, he was the same rank as our Toby Carter, who was disgusted with it all. We were all disgusted with him. I saved him from drinking more, because I just kept getting a little and pouring it out. I never touched it myself. I had a wee sip of it the first time, and no great interest in taste. It was just raw spirit, you know.
And food, you mentioned little things like the frogs on the
yes.
sticks. And,
well, there's nothing. I mean, it was rice. We had our compo rations, mm. which we didn't want to use unless we had to, because it meant you would be left if you had an emergency with nothing. So we occasionally used the compo rations. There was a bit of a fuss. There was a seaplane coming in, and the only place it could land was quite a bit away from where our camp was, and the others all wanted to go because they were bringing in stores, and they wanted to see another white man sort of thing. And they all left. I did the work to skeds and everything, and I wasn't bothering too much, and then they came back. And the first ones just walked past me, never even looked at me. I mean, they were always chatting to each other, and they wouldn't look at me. And then even eventually the CEO passed, and he just, right, he walked on, and there were these two RAF bods with them. It had been decided that we didn't know enough about marking places for the planes to drop stuff to. We've been doing it all the time, but this wasn't good enough. So we're being instructed by these two. Of course, nobody wanted to speak to these two. We tried to be nice. We even opened the compo ration stuff that makes sausages and things for them, and never touched them. And this went on, and finally, of course, came the night time. We went up, we were occupying this huge room in a longhouse where we were staying, and they just didn't know much. We always slept so that we could touch one other person at least, if not two. You're always near enough. If you heard anything or things that were going wrong, all you had to do was to touch somebody and you're waking them up. But they went away further over on their own, and because we just lay down, maybe took our boots off, maybe not. The rest of the clothes they just kept on. Oh, they looked at us as if we're heathens, you know, stripped off and everything else. And that was it. I didn't know what had been going on, but there had been a bit of talk by our three NCOs. So sometime during the night, they had quietly got up, taken all these guys' clothes and everything else, and hidden them at the back of the house. So that when they, and then of course, it was quite early when I got a touch, you see, and I had to go at the back, so we were all at the back there, and these two were lying as the only people in this huge room, and of course, they were not quite starkers underneath, but just about. Because when they wakened up, kind of a stretch, and then looked nobody about, and then no clothes. Everybody, their own lot was just about killing themselves laughing at the antics at that part. I kind of felt sorry for the two of them because it wasn't their fault they were there. So I left out, but they must have been given their clothes again. But they immediately said, would we signal and have them picked up the next day? They didn't want to stay any longer. So we did. But you know, all this going on, the middle of the war now, it's quite ridiculous. There he was.
And this was by, they were dropped in by Catalina?
No, I think they came in by Catalina to unload stores and everything. And it was, I think it was Jumbo Courtney's idea that we didn't know how to do things and all the rest of how to point out where it had to be bombed. Well, I mean, at one time we asked for what was a large encampment of Japs to be bombed. Drop any bombs anywhere in this great big area. That's all we need. It'll flush them out. The area's too big. We don't have enough bombs. You pick somewhere else. It's too small. We can't see. We never got any support from the RAF at all. Not that it was the RAF's fault, but simply just didn't do it, didn't seem to get on to the things. It's quite a thing. And of course, like the food, we occasionally had some of our own compo rations, but very seldom. We lived off the land. I did a very nasty thing. I didn't do it intentionally because I didn't know any better. But the others went off to meet this landing by Catalina and get the stuff. And at lunchtime, the chap came along, and McCann was food, and I nodded yes. So he went away and he came back. Oh, nice bit of chicken and everything. It was a bit tough, but it was all right. I realised when the others came back, that chicken was meant for about six of us. I'd eaten half of it. I was in the doghouse for a bit after that. But there's all these silly things. I would have been, I'd have brought the chicken to me, so I ate it, and that was it. But the food was quite a thing. When I went in, I was 11 stone 2. And after I came out and managed to get myself weight, I was less than 9 stone. I was quite fit. It didn't worry me in the slightest, but that was the way things. You didn't keep weight on in these places, from other point of view. Because, you know, as I say, you got rice, and more rice. Occasionally some sausages we'd have for ourselves. Occasionally a chicken or somebody got it. And the only other thing was, at one time, we had a pig killed. The pigs were roamed about at the longhouses, underneath the longhouses. And this is the other thing, if you wanted to go to the loo for a number two, you worked out in the edge of the jungle, complete with a big stick. And you went there, and you could be sure a pig would follow you. And when you had finished having, before you could even pull up your pants, you had your stick ready, because they seemed to find that human droppings were a real delicacy. It was gone in seconds. So you fed the pigs with your droppings, and then you ate the pig afterwards. But they had this occasional bits of things. One time we'd told them we were going to go on this foray against the Japs, and I wasn't going to go, the others were going with some of the locals who had been taught how to fire rifles and things, and they were going to a place and up at the top of a high bank opposite the Jap encampment. They would fire down on the other side of the river at the Japs, quite safe and everything, just to give the natives something to think about. And when they got about three quarters of the way up the slope, one of them started firing his rifle in the air. They asked him why. It might frighten them, and they'll go away, and we won't have to fight, and we'll be safe. Very logical. That was more or less the attitude. It's not that they couldn't fight, and certainly at Marudi, when the Japs were coming after us, they would go into them like anything, no question about it. But they weren't just exactly going to be chasing after fighting somebody if they could help it.
How were they armed?
Just the parang was the native sword, and you had the blowpipe. Now, I didn't see anybody ever using a blowpipe, but some of them were supposed to have used blowpipes. The actual dart is, I've got the blowpipes next door. The actual bit for putting in the part there. And it's notched at the point, and they put a piece of pith at the other end and put it in the blowpipe and blows it out, and that hitting anything, whether it's a human or an animal, will just more or less feel like a sting of a bee or anything like that, and the tendency is always just to wipe something and that knocks the rest of it off. It's just a very thin sliver of wood, but the actual thing is coated at the point with deadly poison. There's nothing you can do about it if you get it in you. That's the blowpipe thing. But I never saw anybody with us using the blowpipe as such. They didn't like the blowpipes, the locals. It didn't make any bang. Far better with a gun, it makes bangs, and that'll frighten people away. This is their attitude. It's quite logical, but quite interesting.
How about the headhunting aspect as well? Because this was
The headhunting had been finished. It was actually no longer any headhunting in the area we were for a long time. But with the Japs coming, they did execute people deliberately in public. This had happened to quite a few cases. Both British and white people were executed publicly. Just bending down and having their head chopped off with a sword. But it's just one of these situations that I never witnessed anything like that, simply because there was no need to. We weren't involved. We fired guns and they fired guns at us, and that's it. But I never saw anybody using a blowpipe with the intent of killing anybody, simply because they felt a gun was far better. It made a noise. It didn't matter what happened to it, just made a noise. It's just a curious attitude, quite logical attitude if you look at it that way. But we had this odd skirmish with the Japs, but nothing serious from my point of view at all. You just don't know. But otherwise, there's no fuss. Certainly, they would use the any reason for beheading anybody if they could. And this caused the trouble when this small British contingent went off on their own. They were persuaded that somebody was a baddie and had him executed. He was a goodie in actual practice. That's why Toby Carter got the rest, and we kept them with us all the time.
Did they still have the heads and things?
Yes. Oh, yes. Hung up in the rafters, which, as far as I was concerned, the only time it really affected me was when I went on that trip across to along Berawan. They put on a special do for me that one night I was there, and it was more than enough borak. Their system was that you were another guest and you were there, so the headman or the equivalent headman sang a song to you saying what a wonderful person you were and everything else. He was holding a full tumbler of borak and you had to hold it with him, and when the song was over, the whole lot, the audience joined in a chorus, ooh, aye, and that sort of thing. But when it came to the end and he was finished his song, it was a ooh, and you had to drink the whole lot right down. He was holding on it as well as you until it was finished. And that was an essential part of the ceremony. And then, of course, at that time, as soon as that was finished, there was another man, and he came forward with it, and another man, and another one. They were not drinking at all. None of them were drinking. It was all to me. So after about four or five or six, I don't know how many, I knew if this gets on any longer, I'm not going to be any good. So the next one that came along, I drank it, but I held on to the tumbler. Another chap went away, and I indicated I want the tumbler filled, and I took it to the headman, the first man who had sung to me, and I sang to him. I don't remember what I sang, and it wouldn't make sense anyway, and he wouldn't know anything about it, and I got him to drink this, And since he had finished it, oh, his head was going round. it was quite a comic thing. But shortly after that, obviously the Borak was... No, just immediately after that, I was sitting down feeling quite righteous. I had done something to stop them doing this when I felt a gentle squeeze on my arm. I turned around and looked, and he was rather a nice-looking young lady, complete with a tumbler of Borak. So you had no options to take that. And as soon as that was finished, I got a nip on my other shoulder, and this was another young lady. This was their way of trying to get you drunk completely. You know? It was all very nice and all very ceremonial, but after that they went on to the men doing some prancing around with swords and stuff. And then he insisted that I should do a dance. Which was not all that great, but when I was really young, I remember doing either the sailor's hornpipe or what kind of jig thing with my feet. So I did something like that, and I finished off by doing a somersault, which was fine. And everybody clapped and everything. Everything was fine. I got back to my seat, fine, all the rest of it. I'd been wearing a revolver and thing, clothes and everything. I put my hand down. There was no revolver there. The holster was there, but no revolver. I thought, my, are they going to get me drunk or not? Or is this real fun thing and nothing else? Because he started looking up and there's heads all over the place. It wasn't a very comfortable little while. And a young boy came, tapped me on the shoulder and handed me the gun, the pistol. It was a big relief, I can tell you. That fall night when I did the somersault, that was it. And the funny thing was, when I was escorted back by that... Lieutenant Colonel, we stopped at this longhouse, and he was getting into conversations with the chap there, the head man there, and something, I was half sleeping and not listening, because I couldn't follow the speech anyway, and I saw this chap getting up, doing a thing like this, laughing away, and I thought, oh my God, he's told us about what I'd done there, and I thought, I'm in for a real wigging from him. As a lieutenant colonel in the British Army. So I was sore bottom anyway, and I got up and went on the balcony. Shortly after that, they finished their conversation, and he came across and went very close to me. I'm just waiting for it to be told off. And he said, it's one of those things, you know. I said, what? Well, you know, when you're travelling on your own, things can happen. It was at this longhouse here. We'd had a lot to drink. And he said, I did this kind of Highland fling thing with a somersault afterwards. I couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe it. He said, you know, I know it sounds awful to you that anybody would do that. But he said, it was just one of those things, you know. I never told them. It's utterly unbelievable that that would happen. It did. Yes. So you're back to square one.
So you left Borneo, and then how did it all come to an end?
We went back to Australia. We were flown back to Australia. And I had a few days there, not very long, and then we got a ship from Sydney that went back down past Melbourne along the south of Australia, which is supposed to be a very rough bit, Australian Bight. I went for breakfast the next morning. I think there was four of us, that was all. We were first bacon egg the lot. It didn't affect the four of us all the time. We stopped at Perth for part of a day, and one or two of the people who came from Perth came there to see us, and then we went from there up to Bombay, and we had about a week in Bombay, and then came back through the Suez Canal, Mediterranean, Bay of Biscay, back home to Southampton. The other laugh at Southampton was I got off and the customs were there in force. They really were. Every single person was stopped. Every single bag was searched. Every single thing was looked at that way. I had managed to buy three pairs of what were supposed to be silk stockings, but they're a mixture of silk and wool. And the customs officer got me, said, silk stockings. We'll charge you for that. I said, they're not silk stockings. Well, yes, they are. I said, no, they're not. You get your silk testing glass, if you've got one, and you'll find they're a mixture of silk and wool. Oh, I said, I've beaten the customs next. I said, oh, right, you get through double quick. But the one behind me, I knew them, and they came, and they had their stuff examined and everything. Right, well, that's it. No, no, that's not it. Why not? Well, I've got two carcasses of sheep in the freezer of the ship. Oh, come on, you're joking. I mean, this is ridiculous. Get away. He said, no, I've got two sheep's carcasses, and he's got two sheep's carcasses. We heard there was a food rationing at home, so we were bringing back two frozen sheep each. They went off, and they came back with a sheep on their shoulders. They were waved through double quick. Couldn't believe it. I saw one of them a while afterwards in London by chance, and I said, how did the sheep do? Don't speak to me about mutton or lamb. I'm never going to touch that for the rest of my life, because they know refrigerator, I know where to put it, so to farm it out and eat it themselves. He said, I'm sick of eating that. It all comes to an end. But I was just, I was sent home from Southampton, straight back to Cooper Angus, 2 or 3 days, and I was called back to London to be debriefed, sign the Official Secrets Act, and so on. I'd got engaged before I went out to Australia, and my fiancé would be living in Stranraer, so I got the train from London to Stranraer overnight. It jogged along at about 20 miles an hour. It's quite a very good for the Irish boat train. You get into Stranraer any time between 6 and 9 o'clock, it doesn't matter, sort of thing. Train stopped, I got off. I'd never been to Stranraer. I had a rough sketch from Anne, very rough, showing 3 roads I could take from the station to their house. There was nobody there, nobody else got off the train. No boat or anything. I just set off, and I thought I'll choose the middle one. I went along it and found the house. So as a waiter, either ring a bell or bang a knocker, when the door suddenly opened and she was standing inside, she was coming out to meet me, but she was a bit late. So I didn't know what she would think of me the way I was just a bit over 9 stone, but everything went well after that. It was quite a shock for her, I'm sure. So.